hello, everyone. It is time to read the Des Moines Register for this Wednesday, March 6, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Dennis May, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb DeHack. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. And now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Our statewide AccuWeather forecast calls for a mild day today with partial sunshine. Winds from the east-southeast at 7 to 14 miles per hour, and mostly cloudy tonight. Forecast for Des Moines calls for a high today of 57 degrees with a low of 39. Again, mild today with partial sunshine. On Thursday, a high of 58 with a low of 41. Some cloudy and mild, possibility of some PM rain. Across the area, mild with partial sunshine today. Turning over to the headlines in today's Des Moines Register, we have Iowa poll, Register exclusive since 1943. Majority backs social media age restrictions. Another article, Biden claims 91% of vote in Democrats' mail-in caucus. And a return of wet weather could bring Iowa epic nitrate pollution. And here to get us started with today's Des Moines Register is Barb.
Thank you, Dennis. Biden claims 91% of the vote in Democrats' mail-in caucus. For the first time, the party's presidential preferences were cast entirely by mail. President Joe Biden has won Iowa's first-ever mail-in Democratic presidential caucus, according to unofficial results posted Tuesday afternoon. Biden won 91% of the vote, with Democrats selecting his name on 11,083 of the 12,207 preference slips received and processed through Tuesday, the party announced. Biden has not faced a significant challenge in his run for a second term in Iowa. Iowa Democrats could choose to say they were uncommitted to any candidates, and uncommitted was second, with 4% of the vote at 480. Two other names appeared on the preference card. U.S. Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota was third at 3%, or 362 votes, and author Marianne Williamson was fourth at 2%, or 268, the party said. Williamson has since suspended her campaign. Counting will continue through March 8th. Quote, Iowans recognize Biden made great investments in communities across Iowa, including our child care centers, roads, and bridges, and by expanding broadband access in our most rural areas, Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart said in a release. IDP staff has worked hard over the past year to make sure this year's presidential caucus was as accessible as possible. Not only have we reached the turnout numbers that we experienced in 2012, we've exceeded them. That's clear evidence that Iowans are energized and ready to re-elect President Biden. The release was a marked contrast to the excitement and fanfare of past Democratic caucuses when they were first in the nation. There was no gathering spot for Iowa Democrats, no watch parties, and nothing of the kind of media coverage seen in the state just 4 years ago. Following a chaotic 2020 caucus in which the state party failed to report out timely results, National Democrats decided to move away from Iowa as their leadoff state. South Carolina instead led off the party's presidential primary process in 2024, and Democrats in Iowa met at caucuses on January 15th only to conduct party business, while former President Donald Trump won the Republican presidential caucuses on the same night. Iowa Democrats instead cast their presidential preferences entirely by mail. Presidential preference cards could be requested until February 19th. Party officials that said February 22nd that 19,609 Iowans had requested the presidential preference cards. Cards had to be returned to the state party, or postmarked by March 5th to count. The unofficial results show that more than a third of the cards requested had not been turned back in. Turnout numbers have traditionally been difficult to pin down for Democrats, who until recently did not release raw vote totals for each contest, instead relying on a complex formula for state delegate equivalence. News reports differ on the total Democratic turnout in 2012, the last time an incumbent Democrat ran for president. The party officials peg the number at about 15,000. In comparison, Trump received 56,243 votes on January 15th during the Republican caucuses. Hart told the Des Moines Register ahead of the release of the results that the important thing is that Iowa Democrats will know that this process was smooth, it was easy, it was accurate, it was transparent, and that the results are going to be clear to everyone. And when we get that all done, it may seem, I don't know if anticlimactic is the right word, I would just say that we will be relieved that this step of the process is done, she said. And we're proud that we were able to do it in a way that I think is going to be beneficial to Iowa Democrats. Hart told reporters Tuesday at the party's Des Moines headquarters, as preference cards were being tabulated, that doing mail-in caucuses has not disadvantaged the party in hearing from voters about issues. Hart said this year had the most accessible caucus in our entire history. She added, people will tell you, I think, that it was easy to fill out these presidential preference cards to have access to the process. So we're pleased with that. Hart said it's clear from conversations at various events since the last caucus that Democratic voters are concerned about women's reproductive rights, public funding for education, and infrastructure. These are issues that matter to folks, and we are hearing from them exactly why Democrats are determined to get more Democrats elected this time around, she said. We're going to continue to have conversations about how to. We've talked in the past about how we're reimagining these in-person caucuses now, Hart said. And I think that is exactly the way to look at it. It's different. It's a new process. And so we've got to figure out how to create more interest around that, how to get better participation at the in-person caucus, just like looking at the way we tweak the mail-in process. Next time, it is going to be much more competitive. Hart previously told the Register about thoughts regarding 2028. And so it's possible that we may send out preference cards to every single registered Iowa Democrat. I think that would be great if we could make that happen. We could offer Dropbox locations or expand the window in order for more people to participate.
Our next article, return of wet weather could bring Iowa epic nitrate pollution. A buildup of nitrate in farm fields has resulted from Iowa's longest running drought in 40 years has set the stage for potentially massive uptick in stream pollution, state water quality observers say. Research has shown that nitrogen fertilizer that goes unused by crops can quickly be flushed from those fields after a drought year, and Iowa's drought has endured for more than three. The nitrate leaching often is most pronounced during a significant spring rain, when fields have been fertilized but crops aren't yet growing. These extreme events are quickly becoming the rule, said Chris Jones, a former University of Iowa researcher who studies agricultural's effects on water quality. If and when we return to this wet regime, it's going to be epic. An example. In 2013, record spring rainfall lifted the state from one of its worst droughts. The result was a more than 400% increase in the amount of nitrate detected in Iowa streams in 2012 and in 2013, according to data collected by Iowa Nutrient Research Center. With stream flow data taken into account, 2013 was nearly the worst year in two recent decades for nitrate pollution. The absolute amount of nitrate in the stream statewide trended upward until 2016. Climate predictions show this spring might be warmer and wetter than normal. State climatologist Justin Glisson said that increases the likelihood of thunderstorms and heavier rainfalls, but he said it's impossible to say whether this spring will mimic 2013. Nitrogen is a key nutrient for Iowa corn to ensure maximum crop yields. It often is added to fields with synthetic fertilizers and livestock manure. But it poses environmental threats beyond the fields. Rivers are a significant source of drinking water for large cities, notably those in the Des Moines metro. And nitrate must sometimes be removed from the water to make it safe for drinking. Des Moines Water Works spent about $150,000 on nitrate removal in 2022. Further elevated levels of nitrate and another prominent nutrient, phosphorus, can wreak havoc on aquatic ecosystems, leading to algae blooms that diminish oxygen in the water and release toxins that are harmful to swimmers. The crop fertilizers are leading contributors to the Gulf of Mexico's dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi River, which drains much of Iowa. The release of nitrate into Iowa streams is expedited by the state's expansive network of underground tiling. Those perforated pipes drain soggy fields to improve crop production, but also provide a quicker pathway for nitrates into streams. About half of the state's cropland is drained by tile, according to Iowa State University. A recently released survey by the U.S. Department of Agriculture showed a decrease in underground tiling in recent years, but it's unclear why. In drought years, the amount of nitrate and phosphorus in streams is expected to diminish. There is less water absorbing nitrate in the soil and less surface erosion, which causes phosphorus leaching. That is reflected by the state's stream monitoring data. Nutrient loads in 2020 and 2021 fell to some of their lowest levels in two decades. Parts of Iowa have been suffering from drought conditions since July of 2020. About 79% of the state has some measure of drought now. But in 2022, the monitoring data for which was recently published by the state, there was an increase in stream nitrate. That's despite 2022 having slightly less average rainfall statewide than 2021. Matt Helmers, who leads the Nutrient Research Center, attributes the jump to the buildup of nitrate during the drought and the rains that fell in months when crops weren't growing. 3 months in 2022 had above normal rainfall, according to state weather data, March, November, and December, and fall outside of the state's traditional growing season. Commercial fertilizer sales also reached a new record in Iowa in 2022, according to the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and farmers have been increasingly fertilizing their fields in the fall. That creates the potential for additional stream pollution because the nutrients aren't in the soil for longer periods when crops aren't growing. State agricultural officials have sought with greater fervor in recent years to help farmers implement edge-of-field conservation practices. The projects are meant to slow the release of surface runoff and underground water flows and to remove nutrients from them before they reach streams. The impact of that work on the state's overall water quality is not yet clear, Helmer said. The monitoring that folks are doing shows that those practices are effective, but we do need to recognize they're still treating a pretty small percentage of the landscape, he said. Last year, Republican lawmakers cut a third of the Iowa Nutrient Research Center's funding and moved the money to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship to help pay for the projects. The annual $500,000 sum matched what the research center had devoted to operate the Iowa Water Quality Information System, which aggregates real-time nitrate contamination data. Opponents of the move feared it might doom the system. Without data, it will be easy to say there's no problem, or we don't know how to measure the problem, Senator Janice Weiner, Democrat from Iowa City, said last year. Instead, the research center cut its funding of the system by a third, but retained enough money to operate its network of 70 monitoring sites, said Larry Weber, director of the IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa, which operates the system. The monitoring sites are especially valuable because they provide continuously updated data about nitrate concentrations, Weber said, whereas other monitoring by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources happens just once a month. The DNR samples for a much wider range of contaminants. Data from both sets of monitoring sites are used by the Nutrient Research Center to calculate annual nutrient loads. While the funding cut isn't expected to disrupt the UI monitoring network itself, it will impede the analysis of the data the network produces. It's easy to collect data, Weber said. Our staff provide an incredible support to the Nutrient Research Center at ISU, which relies on our researchers to analyze and assess. The state's nitrate data has shown an overall decline in stream pollution in recent years, but because of the drought, it is difficult to discern which way the situation is trending overall. Opinions about that trend vary. Helmers at the research center said it's hard to tell year after year, adding that so-called batch and build conservation program that has pioneered in Polk County has led to a quicker adoption of edge-of-field practices. That idea, to build bioreactors and buffers along multiple farms in a small region, has been adopted by state agricultural officials and is now one of the primary chosen weapons against stream contamination. We still need to scale up, Helmer said, get even more adoption of those practices. Don McDowell, communications director for the State Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, said Iowans recognize that our variable weather will always introduce ups and downs as we move toward achieving our long-term nutrient reduction strategy goals. McDowell did not comment specifically on the department's views of the long-term trends, but said the state has broken records for conservation and water quality adoption in each of the last 2 years. The state's recent initiatives have more than doubled the dollars spent on conservation practices since the adoption, in 2013, of the Nutrient Reduction Strategy, which prioritizes the voluntary efforts of farmers to curb their pollution. Its goal is to reduce the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that leaves farm fields by 45%. McDowell noted that farmers are now planting cover crops on nearly 4 million acres of cropland, up from nearly none a decade ago. Those crops are planted after harvesting fields that might otherwise be bare and help to control erosion and absorb nutrients that could go into streams. That acreage amounts to about 17% of the total that is planted with corn and soybeans each year. We know that these water quality practices work, and we are firmly committed toward accelerating the pace of their adoption, McDowell said. Farmers can be hesitant to change their practices because of the risks those changes pose. It may be a slower process than many would like, but from a perspective from the farmer, I'm jeopardizing my ability to stay in business if I make the bad decision, Roger Zylstra, a Jasper County farmer, has said. Alicia Vasto, Water Program Director for the Iowa Environmental Council, said, "Things are not trending in the direction that everyone wants to say they are. The council has criticized the state nutrient strategy and has estimated that it will take many decades to reach its goal based on the progress that has been made so far." Vasto said that at minimums, farmers should be required to create buffers between their fields and streams, that fertilizer application should be more restricted. Jones, the author and former UI researcher, says, "I think there can be no doubt that the long-term trend for nitrogen is up. At the same time that we're implementing conservation, we're also doing stuff to make it worse. That includes installing significant amounts of new drainage tile and increasing the use of fertilizers. When you look at the new nitrogen load from the new tile, that dwarfs the conservation practices," Jones said. He said the best solution to the state's water quality woe is to diversify crops, a seismic shift from away from the well-entrenched focus on corn and soybeans that would require retreating from ethanol. "Ethanol has got to die," Jones said. "It just has to if we're going to improve this environment condition in Iowa. That is unlikely, at least in the foreseeable future. More than half of the state's corn is used to produce ethanol, and state leaders have pushed to expand its use. Site emissions from ethanol plants to sequestration sites that potentially pose to increase the fuel's longevity despite federal goals to shift to electric cars. The state is required to deliver a report on the status of Iowa's waterways to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in the coming weeks. That update, which is required every 2 years, will list the streams, lakes, and wetlands that the Iowa Department of Natural Resources deems impaired. The impairments can include contamination by nitrates and other pollutants. It could be elevated bacteria counts and lackluster fish populations and diversity, among others. In its 2022 assessment, the DNR noted more than 750 impaired waterways.
And in the Iowa poll, a majority backs social media age restrictions. A majority of Iowans support legislation that would require children to have their parents' permission to have social media accounts, a new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll shows. House File 2523, introduced in the legislature on February 1st and sponsored by more than a dozen Republicans, is meant to give parents and guardians more oversight over their child's internet usage on platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. The bill would allow the Iowa Attorney General and users to sue social media companies for violating the parental authorization rules. The Iowa poll asked Iowans whether they favor or oppose legislation that would require parental approval for people under 18 to have a social media account. More than half of Iowans, 55%, say they favor the bill, while 42% oppose it. The remaining 3% are not sure. The Iowa poll, conducted by Seltzer & Company, surveyed 804 Iowans from February 25th to 27th. It has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Support among Iowa parents with children under 18 is similar to support from all adults, with 37% of parents in favor and 41% opposed. Logan Grove, a 37-year-old parent and poll respondent from Pella, favors the bill, saying it would provide parents a leg up on monitoring kids' social media usage. For a child to get their hands on social media at a young age without some sort of parental control is opening Pandora's box, Grove said. I mean, there's too much stuff on there that they can get their hands on already just by doing a Google search. Grove acknowledged pros and cons to the whole electronic world. Grove grew up in the MySpace era, which he said was a way to connect with friends, and now his 10-year-old son has a Snapchat chat account and occasionally watches TikTok but hasn't asked for other social media accounts. Grove said social media has lost its roots, instead becoming a place filled with negativity and political rhetoric. It also opens kids up to scammers and predators and takes away from life outside, he said. But I think because these kids are sucked into it, they're not like the way we were growing up. We were outside. We weren't sitting in front of the TV all the time, he said. And now they see nothing but negative stuff. Well, their lives are negative because of it. The poll results reflect differences across party lines, with 61% of Iowa Republicans in favor of the bill, while 35% oppose it. In contrast, only 39% of Democrats support the bill, while a majority, 55%, do not. Among independents, 57% favor the bill, while 42% oppose it. Support for the bill also varies among age groups, the poll shows. 59% of Iowans age 45 and older support the legislation, while 52% of Iowans under age 35 oppose it. Malcolm McDougall, a 26-year-old parent from Cedar Rapids, said on his face the legislation sounds like a good idea, but he questions how it might be implemented and how it may encroach on privacy. Logistically speaking, the only way that this can really be reinforced requires giving up so much personal liberty to sort of a probably unaccountable government agency that I don't feel comfortable with, especially in its current form, he said. But McDougall said generally social media platforms should be wiped off the face of the planet. He takes several precautions in his online presence, like using a VPN and avoiding posting pictures of his one-year-old daughter online. If passed, the bill would allow parents to revoke social media permission for their children at any time. Social media companies would be forbidden to collect data on children who created accounts without permission from their parent or guardian, and would be required to provide a parent with a password or other ways to access and monitor their child's posts, setting, messages, and time spent on the platform. Under the legislation, Iowa's Attorney General would have authority to bring a civil lawsuit against any company that violates the parental permission requirements and seek damages totaling $1,000 per violation. Iowans harmed using the platform would also be able to file lawsuits and seek damages of either $10,000 for each violation or more for actual damages if a court decides that the company's violation was a direct cause of the harm. The bill has garnered support from conservative religious groups, including the Family Leader, Iowa Catholic Conference, and Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition. Those in opposition include TechNet, a trade group whose members include tech companies and social media providers. The bill passed out of committee, but has not been taken up by either chamber.
Turning now over to the Metro and Iowa section, our headlines, Heitzes and testifies in discrimination trial. Eight majors recommended for chopping block at Drake University, and a battle against Casey's store in Windsor Heights comes to a close. I read eight majors recommended for chopping block at Drake. Current students will be allowed to finish the programs on schedule. 4% of Drake University students could see their degree programs eliminated under cost-cutting measures recommended by the college to help recoup budget deficits. Drake University Provost Sue Madison announced that at a faculty program review launched in November, has recommended the discontinuance of 13 undergraduate majors, minors, and certificates. In an email to faculty sent Friday, Madison said, 9 faculty members have been notified that their academic program and the faculty line were recommended for termination. Madison said in her message that program reviews like the one that led to the recommendations are essential to ensuring the university is meeting societal needs, satisfying student interests, and providing a quality education. It's important for institutions like ours to periodically review our academic programs and curriculum and the makeup of our operating budget, as we have many times in our 143-year history, to ensure we're well-positioned for the future, Drake University President Marty Martin said in a statement. This work demands that we make difficult decisions, but also presents an opportunity to invest in academic innovation that meets evolving student needs while focusing on expanding college access opportunities, all to ensure a prosperous future for our institution and our students. The program reviews and recommendations were one of several measures taken, including curriculum reviews, to reach a balanced budget, Madison said in her message to campus. The review also served to ensure Drake's future as a mission-driven institution that provides outstanding educational opportunities. Students currently enrolled in programs that could be axed will be provided with plans to finish their degree on schedule, Madison said in her message to the campus community. And students who are hoping to enter into these programs will be able to pivot to similar areas of study with individualized help and guidance. As for the faculty members whose programs or positions have been recommended for termination, they have until April 1st to submit evidence that retaining the program is in the best interest of the institution, Madison said in an email to faculty. Madison, faculty senate committees, and deans will review the submissions before they make final recommendations to the faculty senate. Here are the programs recommended for discontinuation. From the undergraduate majors, anthropology, sociology, astronomy, physics, religion, rhetoric, healthcare administration. Undergraduate minors, anthropology, religion, rhetoric, and East Asian studies. Graduate majors, Master of Accountancy and Master of Public Administration. And graduate certificates, Evidence-Based Healthcare. The Faculty Senate will vote on the recommendations at its April 17th meeting, after which Martin will review them and bring them to the Board of Trustees to vote on. He will share the results with the campus community on April 29th, Madison said. There is no easy way to receive this message for those whose positions are being recommended for elimination, Madison said in the email. Please continue to support colleagues whose lives have just been upended. Discussions around academic program cuts began in November when Madison told the Faculty Senate that previous budget cuts and revenue-driving efforts, like investing in new programs, would be enough to fill a gap. At the time, Martin said the budget deficit came in at around $10.3 million, when factoring in the end of one-time and temporary reductions. According to a message Martin released to campus on February 7th, the university is working to have a balanced budget by July of 2025 and plans to reduce costs by 5.1% in fiscal year 2025, which starts in July of 2024. According to minutes of Drake University's January 31st Faculty Senate meeting obtained by the Iowa Capital Dispatch, the university needs to cut around $14.3 million from its $132 million operating budget, or just under 11%, based on budgeting exercises in 2023. The cuts would occur across fiscal years 2025 and 2026, Martin said in the minutes, and the target of the university is trying to reach for fiscal year 2025 is $11 million in reductions, in order to bring the deficit down to $3 million, approved by the Board of Trustees. The reductions would come from across the university, not just academic areas. Martin said that by June 30th of 2026, the university's operating budget must be balanced. He said the numbers can change depending on factors that aren't solid yet, like future enrollment counts, and he's anxious about how the delays to the federal student aid application process could impact the budget outlook. The January 31st meeting minutes said that if all the temporary cuts made in fiscal year 2024 were reversed, the university would need to reduce costs by 8.5% in order to reach a $3 million deficit for fiscal year 2025. If the cuts were to be made permanently, that number would fall to 5.1% or $6.7 million based on the $132 million operating budget. The Academic Affairs Unit of the university makes up at around 62% of the total operating budget, the minutes asked, or minutes said. One commenter during the meeting asked if the unit would need to cut 62% of $11 million, or around $6.8 million, to which Madison concurred. With the other areas that report to Madison also making cuts and contributing to the $6.8 million, she said in the minutes that Academic Affairs would need to cut $2.5 million to $3 million more to meet the gap. That number also could change, she said. Madison said in the minutes that the current estimated savings due to the reduction of adjudicant faculty and reliance on visiting assistant professors is $1.6 million, and that, at the time, 10 faculty members had elected to participate in a faculty transitional sabbatical program, saving more money. In fiscal year 2024, which ends this summer, the minutes said, 45% of budget reductions, of which many were temporary, came from academic units and the rest from other areas. In 2023, one non-academic department cut 23% of its positions and another eliminated 8% with comparable cuts made in other units. All areas except academic and administrative units are planning their budget reductions for fiscal year 2025, rather than spreading them out across the next two fiscal years, in order to give the academic units more time to prepare. Martin said in the minutes that he didn't ask the Board of Trustees for more time, and that all departments need to do their best to hit the balanced budget in the set time frame. If, for some reason, that proves to be impossible, then we will adapt, he said in the minutes. Drake University's assets totals $568 million, almost half of which are endowment investments, Martin said in his message, and less than $50 million in the debt in relation to those assets. Drake University has navigated through many challenging periods in our 143-year history. Each time, struggles notwithstanding, the university has grown stronger, Madison said in her message to campus. As we work together to face this most recent challenge, I'm confident that we will leave a mission-focused legacy for another 143 years and beyond.
Heitzhusen testifies in discrimination trial. Sonia Heitzhusen said she knew right away that her termination was not on the level. The veteran WHO 13 news anchor was told on April 3, 2020, that the station where she'd worked for 17 years was ending her contract. Her bosses offered to help her land a new job with a sister station or to call her back when new jobs opened, she says. News director Rod Peterson even suggested there might be a job for her then, working on the station's website, but with a catch. He said it doesn't pay the same, and nothing on air, nothing on camera. And when I heard that, I knew it was like a punch to the gut, Heitzhusen testified this week in Polk County Court. It meant I was good enough to work behind the scenes, I was good enough to work on the web, but we don't want you in front of the camera. At 52, Heitzhusen was the oldest female anchor at WHO, where she'd built a reputation as a versatile journalist covering both investigative stories and features. Now 56, she is suing WHO, parent company Nexstar Media, Peterson, and general manager Bobby Tulch, alleging age and gender discrimination. The case went to trial last week, and on Monday, Heitzhusen took her turn on the witness stand. In at times tearful testimony, Heitzhusen spoke about her love for her job, the sense of purpose she'd lost when it was gone, and the signs she'd seen, even before her termination, that women were not on a level playing field with men. She said they included station management running promotions to celebrate awards for male, but not female, reporters, and allowing men, but not women, to promote their side jobs on the air. Men are often allowed to age on television, get gray hair, maybe be a little heavier than they were at 20. Women aren't afforded that luxury, she testified. Women are expected to be not only professional, but beautiful and young and glamorous. Hyde Chusen testified that Peterson, her direct supervisor, had a pattern of making comments about her age and weight even before she was let go. In one meeting, when she and co-anchor Aaron Kiernan were asking for more resources for a segment about exercise, Peterson allegedly told them, "Well, at least you're losing weight." At another staff meeting, after Hyde Chusen had missed work due to a reaction to the shingles vaccine, Peterson reportedly told younger workers not to worry, quote, "because you're not of Sonia's advanced age," end quote. Quote, "You are trying to outrun the hands of time. You're doing everything you can to keep a youthful appearance," Hyde Chusen said. "What that said to me was, you're at the age now where you're on the radar, where we're looking at how old you are and whether you can continue on and keep on outrunning the hands of time." Hyde Chusen's longtime friend Kiernan, who still works for WHO, also testified, recounting the meeting where Peterson commented on their weight. She shared Hyde Chusen's view that the station was doling out recognition and other perks unevenly. "Several years ago, there were promos running for some of my male colleagues' awards, and in the same time frame, and even the same organization that bestows these awards, I had won awards, Sonia had won awards, and there were not promos running for what we had earned," Kiernan said. She described Hyde Chusen as one of the smartest, hardest-working people in the newsroom, but testified that the two of them consistently got fewer resources in terms of staff support and runtime for their stories than male colleagues received. Hyde Chusen's testimony came after the initial week of the trial focused mostly on station executives, who have argued Hyde Chusen was let go as part of a broader layoff based on her higher compensation and less essential work duties than those of other anchors. Her attorneys grilled Peterson and Touch about her tenure at the station, its 2019 acquisition by Netstar, the nation's largest owner of TV stations, and how the decision was made to end her contract. Many of the questions revolved around a marketing plan Peterson forwarded to WHO news staff in 2017, which listed as one of the state's strengths its, quote, "hip, young, relatable talent," end quote. A similar 2019 document omitted young. Peterson denied considering age as a factor in hiring and firing, and Touched, who was hired as part of the Netstar transition, called the document a joke that had no bearing on any of his decisions. Her attorneys also focused on a document produced by Peterson for Touched, reviewing five news anchors being considered for the layoff, including photos and biographical details. The top four on the list were women, led by Hyde Chusen, and her attorneys argued the document falsely denigrated her work performance and relationships in the newsroom. Touch, on the stand, agreed that by the time he received the document, he had largely decided who would be included in the layoff, but denied pressuring Peterson to include false information to justify letting go of Hyde Chusen. During cross-examination Monday, the station's lawyers pressed Hyde Chusen on why she hadn't sought any other media jobs after leaving WHO, including multiple openings at Des Moines' other broadcast news stations, WOI and KCCI. Since hired as spokesperson for the Iowa State Auditor's Office, she told them she has been expecting a callback to WHO as promised, and assumed her lawsuit meant the end of any path for her to return to TV news. "I sacrificed a career that I loved in order to bring this to light," she said. Her attorneys also probed why Hyde Chusen was not called and offered other positions that opened at the station after her layoff. Peterson pointed to a letter Hyde Chusen sent to Netstar officials in 2020 that, he said, denigrated her former co-workers and indicated she was not interested in working for him again. That creates its own problems for the station, since Hyde Chusen's letter alleged sex and age discrimination, and she now accuses the company of retaliating by refusing to offer her further jobs. Peterson, though, said he hadn't seen the letter directly and denied knowing it had included discrimination claims. "She didn't want to work for us. She indicated she didn't," he said. "Why would we call someone who didn't want to work for us?" Peterson also shared the emotions in the courtroom, at one point breaking down in tears on the stand. I worked with Sonia for 14 years, and obviously you saw what I wrote about her in performance reviews and thought her about her. So, yes, the lawsuit has been tough," he testified afterward.
Our next story from the Metro and Iowa section. Battle against Casey's store in Windsor Heights comes to a close. After a decade-long battle against more gas stations on the city's main thoroughfare, Windsor Heights residents came out in droves this week as their city council approved a site plan for a Casey's General Store. The council voted 5-1 Monday night to greenlight a proposal from Casey's to put a convenience store and a gas station at 6961 University Avenue, just east across 70th Street from the suburban city's Hy-Vee store. To the north, the properties are single-family homes, and to the west of Hy-Vee and University is a come-and-go station. Representatives from Casey's presented several changes to the proposal, addressing criticism they'd heard in the weeks leading up to the meeting. Council members passed the measure on the condition that Casey's pursue good-faith discussions to include electrical vehicle charging stations and solar panels in their final designs. Aaron Wolf, site development manager for Casey's, said the Ankeny-based multi-state chain would be open to discussing solar, but that the level of demand didn't justify the cost of installing charging stations. Council member Joseph Jones pushed back. Quote, "We want you to make a real effort in incorporating every green practice you can possibly think of into this project and strongly consider putting in EV stations," Jones said. "We understand your argument, and we just don't believe you." Casey's did not provide a timeline for the project, which entails demolishing the aging two-story office structure to clear the way for the 4,283-square-foot convenience store. A report from city staff said the project would cost up to $5 million, and the sale of fuel, prepared foods, and other goods would produce significant tax revenues for the city, an estimated $55,000 annually, Casey's claimed. It also would create between 25 and 35 full-time and part-time jobs. While Casey's was able to obtain a conditional use permit for 6961 University Avenue in early February, the city's Plan and Zoning Commission recommended denial of the site plans on February 28th. The commission heard from several residents who argued that the store would harm their property values and worsen traffic along the University Avenue corridor. City received comments from 43 individuals opposing the Casey's and 14 in support. In 2014, Windsor Heights residents beat back a similar attempt by Hy-Vee to build a Fast and Fresh at the same intersection, citing noise and fumes. The store ended up on the city's northern border, replacing an existing gas station on Hickman Road. "I like Casey's Pizza too," resident Julie Earnhardt told the city council on Monday. "I'm not against that at all. I just would hope that there would be a better use of that property." The office building, owned by the Colby family of Colby Interest, is currently 40% vacant. The real estate development and management company has developed as much as half of the residential property in Windsor Heights over the years and owns the land the city's Walmart Supercenter and Sam's Club occupy. Brian Sheriff, president of Colby Interest, said the company had entered into talks with Chick-fil-A, Walgreens, CVS, and Slim Chickens, but that Casey's was the best fit for the property. When asked about ways to utilize the existing building, Sheriff reminded the council that he had made the city aware of the property's availability months ago. Council members Michael Libby confirmed there had been discussions to move Windsor Heights administrative offices from the building it currently shares with Claire Family Dental to the Colby office building. "I was hoping to get a lot further along if there was interest from the city by now," Sheriff said. "I don't think I've seen enough interest or any interest in that idea." Aside from the economic benefits to the city, representatives of Casey's said their development will help rectify several existing issues with the site, including providing stormwater management controls on a property where none are currently present. In response to critiques that the plans didn't prioritize pedestrian safety, Wolf presented updated site plans that shift the sidewalk to create more distance between traffic and pedestrians. A direct path from the sidewalk to the storefront was added at the southwest corner of our building to give pedestrians access to the store without requiring them to walk across the parking lot. Casey's also committed to planting shade trees along 70th Street. City code allows us to pave 100% of that lot, but we've chosen to maintain that green space there, Wolf said. It almost represents an oasis of green space in a sea of concrete from the adjacent properties between the Hy-Vee and the Aldi's.
And turning back to the national news section, but with more local news items. Ankeny City Council approves the widening of Magazine Road. The Ankeny City Council approved a construction project to widen Southwest Magazine Road near the district at Prairie Trail and add a new lane. The project is on the west leg of the intersection of Magazine Road and Southwest State Street and will add a second eastbound through lane on Magazine Road, starting a few hundred feet west of State Street near the Vintage Lake Lofts. The median will be extended to lengthen the left turn lane and convert the access points immediately west of State Street to right turn in and right turn out only. The council approved the $290,000 contract for the project with Monats Incorporated of Johnston at its Monday meeting. Public Works Director Mark Muller told the council that the project is meant to improve traffic capacity and safety at the intersection, especially during peak traffic hours. There are common lines and long delays for drivers going east, city documents say. Work will need to begin no earlier than May 28th and no later than June 10th. Construction will need to be substantially finished within 40 working days. Magazine Road just west of State Street will be closed to traffic during construction. There will be lane closures on the east side of Magazine Road and the north and south sections of State Street. One north and south lane on State Street will be open at all times. The detour route, while the west leg of Magazine Road is closed, will be State Street and Southwest Vintage Parkway, according to information presented at the meeting. A Des Moines pastor is sentenced for indecent exposure incident. A Des Moines pastor who pleaded guilty to indecent exposure will avoid prison. Jose Artero Flores, 48, was charged in early 2023 with assault with intent to commit sexual abuse, an aggravated misdemeanor, and sexual exploitation by a counselor, and assault with intent to commit sexual abuse, a Class D felony that was dismissed by the court. At a sentencing hearing Monday, he was given 2 years of probation. The court suspended a sentence of 1 year in prison. The victim gave an impact statement at Artero Flores' sentencing. She said Artero Flores not only traumatized her, but also her infant daughter, who was present during the incident. The victim said after the encounter, her daughter was too afraid to go to the living room, causing her to have to move. Artero Flores, pastor for Palabra Viva Iowa, a Latino church in the Drake neighborhood of Des Moines, exposed his genitals to the woman and made further unwanted communications. According to court documents, Artero Flores reached out to the victim via Facebook and offered to go to her house for a relationship counseling. The victim asked Artero Flores to leave after he exposed himself and made unwanted advances. However, Artero Flores admitted that had the victim allowed him to return, he would have had sex with her. Letters of support for Artero Flores were submitted to the court as part of the defense's attempts to get Artero Flores a deferred judgment, citing his involvement in the community and his inability to continue his practice as a pastor. In response, Nan Horvat, the attorney representing the state, said, "I don't care if he can't pastor a church, he shouldn't." In addition to probation, Artero Flores will have to register as a sex offender and complete the sex offender treatment program. A no-contact order with the victim is in place for 5 years. And a Des Moines pedestrian dies a week after he was struck by a car. A pedestrian who was in critical condition after he was struck by a car last week has died. Polk County deputies were dispatched to the 4800 block of Northeast 14th Street shortly before 8 p.m. on February 27th regarding a crash, said Captain Ryan Evans, a spokesperson. Deputies found an unconscious man in the roadway just outside of Des Moines city limits near Interstate 80. The victim has been identified as Ronald Edward Yarbrough, 62, of Des Moines, according to a news release. Yarbrough was pronounced dead Tuesday morning. The driver of the vehicle stayed on the scene and cooperated with investigators, Evans said. Yarbrough was transferred to the hospital, where he was listed in critical condition until his death. Investigators believe Yarbrough was crossing a road in a poorly lit area and was wearing all black, Evans said. The area where Yarbrough was hit does not have sidewalks or crosswalks. The investigation is still ongoing.
Athletes' lawyers say investigators withheld evidence. Attorneys for Iowa State University athletes charged in a gambling probe accused Iowa Department of Public Safety Commissioner Stephen Bayon's office in a statement Monday of withholding evidence that favored their clients' now dismissed cases. Lawyers Matt Bowles and Van Plum, along with members of the Sandy Law Firm, said in a joint statement that the Department of Public Safety failed to disclose that investigators lost access to software for tracking apps such as those used for online betting after the manufacturer withdrew it over concerns they may have misused it. The defense attorney said that they discovered that information through an open records request, which prompted them to file a motion last week to suppress evidence. On Friday, citing their discovery, Assistant Story County Attorney Benjamin Matchin asked a judge to dismiss the charges against four former Iowa State athletes. The lawyer's statement Monday was in response to a one bans issued Friday afternoon, defending the gambling investigation. They called Bans' statement deeply concerning. DPS doubling down on its support of the investigation is alarming, and its failure to disclose some of the aforementioned exculpatory information to the prosecution appears to have been concerning enough for the Story County Attorney's Office to dismiss its pending criminal cases against our clients, the lawyers wrote. Story County Attorney Tim Meals did not return multiple messages seeking comment Monday. DPS spokesperson Tawny Cruz said that the department would not comment on the case beyond Bayon's statement, in which he defended the actions of the Division of Criminal Investigation, which is part of the DPS. The DCI launched the investigation into gambling among Iowa State and University of Iowa athletes last year. The case drew criticism in January after the athletes' lawyers in court motions said the chief investigator, DCI Special Agent Brian Sanger, disclosed in a deposition that he had used the tracking software without a warrant. The lawyers have not shared the transcript of Sanger's deposition. In 2022, GeoComply gave Sanger and other agents access to the software called Cabana, which allows users to see where people are opening sportsbook apps like FanDuel and DraftKings. Sanger allegedly used the software to track whether people were using the apps inside University of Iowa athletic buildings. According to defense attorneys, the DCI then tracked activity inside Iowa State athletic buildings. Prosecutors brought criminal cases against 24 athletes and student managers, accusing the defendants of underage gambling and identity theft. The latter charge was based on athletes' alleged use of betting apps registered to family members or friends. Defense attorneys for four former Iowa State athletes filed a motion to suppress evidence Friday, revealing that the DCI lost access to the bet tracking software in January. On October 26th, emails show, GeoComply Government Relations Director Gabriel Engel told Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission officers that the company was drafting a letter confirming that we intend to turn off Cabana access for the DCI. The Gaming Commission is separate from the DCI and regulates sportsbooks. Engel then informed the Gaming Commission on January 25th, email, that GeoComply would cut off the DCI's access to Cabana the next day, because the department's investigators may have exceeded the intended and outlined scope of its Cabana access and use privileges. A GeoComply spokesperson did not respond to messages from the Des Moines Register seeking comment. Matchin, the Story County prosecutor, in his motion to dismiss the charges February 27th, said GeoComply officials also had not responded to his messages. In their statement Monday, the defense attorneys attacked the DPS for issuing a statement on January 31st in which it defending this DCI's investigation. The DPS said DCI agents had consulted with an unnamed lawyer to ensure their use of Cabana was legal. At the time of that statement, the defense attorneys noted Monday, GeoComply already had stripped the DCI of the betting tracking software. The lawyers added that they did not learn about GeoComply's actions until late February, when the Gaming Commission provided emails to the Spirit Lake-based Sandy Law Firm in response to its open records request. DPS knew, or should have known, that the stated basis and ultimate termination of DCI's Cabana access was exculpatory evidence that should have been disclosed to the state prosecuting the individuals criminally charged in DCI's collegiate gambling investigation, the defense attorneys wrote. In a statement after a judge dismissed the charges, Baines implied that the Story County's attorney's office backed down from the cases because of public pressure. Had the situation not involved college athletes, the public perception may have been entirely different. The judge dismissed cases against former Iowa State running back Jerry Brock, defensive lineman Isaiah Lee, wrestler Panero Johnson, and defensive end Ioma Uezurik. DCI Assistant Director David Jobes told the Register on January 23rd that the probe netted 16 guilty pleas. A judge moved one case to juvenile court, where proceedings are private. Prosecutors dismissed one case in September against former Iowa State tight end Deshaun Hanukkah. And a bill would ban income program like Polk County's Uplift. The Iowa House has passed legislation banning local governments from adopting or enforcing guaranteed income programs targeting Polk County-based pilot initiatives that provides 110 people with $500 per month. Uplift, a program put on by 36 organizations across central Iowa, sends the unrestricted monthly payments to participants to assist in covering the cost of basic needs. The program and others like it would be banned under House File 2319, passed on a 55-43 vote Monday. Seven Republicans joined Democrats in opposition. The Attorney General's office under the bill would be able to send cease and desist orders to any county that adopts or enforces a program that provides guaranteed income. The legislation would also open counties that violate the ban to lawsuits. Representative Steve Holt, a Republican from Denison, has called guaranteed income proposals socialism on steroids, saying Uplift and programs like it undermine employers and we're not welcome in Iowa. Just as we do not allow cities and counties to have different laws on murder, we're not going to allow cities and counties to murder our work ethic, Holt said. Democrats argued that the bill would undermine local authority and advocates' efforts to reduce poverty. Great things can happen at the local level, and this bill takes away cities and counties' ability to solve local issues, and perhaps leads us to better public policy, said Representative Beth Wessel Crochel, Democrat from Ames. Under the bill, Uplift would be allowed to remain in effect until January 1st of 2025. The pilot phase of the program is scheduled to end on May of 2025, after 2 years of monthly payments. Work study and other training programs are exempt under the bill, which specifies the programs as those that provide regular, periodic cash payments that are unearned and may be used for any purpose. Upon its introduction, the bill also received opposition from the Des Moines Area Religious Council, the Iowa Public Health Association, and one of the groups invested in Uplift, which argued that cutting off the program early would hamper its ability to collect valuable data. Led by the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, Uplift is supported by Polk County and receives funding from 11 public and private sources. Participants receive debit cards reloaded each month with $500. The vast majority, at 81%, of the program's 110 participants are Polk County residents, and at least 65% live in the metropolitan area. The group, many of which are working full-time, reported earning an average household income of just over $24,000 annually.